From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, life in post-apartheid South Africa, we talk with journalist David Goodman about some of the people he's profiled, including a former member of the South African police and the black minister he interrogated and tortured. Also, how to shop for today's leaner meat and prepare it so it still winds up juicy and tender. We talk with Bruce Adels, author of The Complete Meat Cookbook. And linguist Jeff Nunberg comments on the fashionable use of English words in Europe. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Villard Books, publishers of Running to the Mountain, A Journey of Faith and Change by John Katz.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his new book about South Africa, journalist David Goodman writes, "In the years since the end of white minority rule, everything has changed and nothing has changed." He elaborates on that in a series of profiles of people who straddle the great divides of South African society, rich and poor, famous and obscure, powerful and weak, white and black. Goodman first went to South Africa in 1984. He's written for The Nation, Mother Jones, and the Boston Globe. His new book is called Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa. South Africa will be holding national elections this spring to replace Nelson Mandela, who became president in 1994. I asked Goodman for his evaluation of Mandela's presidency.
You might say that reconciliation became the civil religion under Mandela. Indeed, he took every opportunity to preach it both in his personal and political life, going to visit the wife of the former prime minister who imprisoned him back in the early 60s. This was shortly after he became president. And even a time when I accompanied him, when he returned to the jail where he spent the last 3 years of his 27-year incarceration, and he met with the warder, the prison guard, who in many ways was more a servant and a cook than a conventional jailer. So I would say that Mandela has done a remarkable job at keeping his country together and doing something that no one thought possible in South Africa, which was keeping it from boiling over into war. Mandela's successor is most likely to be a man named Thabo Mbeki, his deputy. And I think Mbeki will have a much more difficult job. Mandela was something of a saint. Mbeki is a mere politician and will suffer the consequences that often go with politicians trying to bring people together.
So assuming Mbeki does become the next president, what kind of president do you think he might be?
Mandela has both a large domestic following, popular following in South Africa. He's enormously popular, and an international following where he's viewed as one of the preeminent world statesmen. Mbeki does not have that kind of popularity. He was in exile during the African National Congress's decades-long liberation struggle against the white minority government, and as such, he has not cultivated the personal following or the moral stature that Mandela has. One of the things that I saw in touring South Africa was the enormous amount of poverty that remains, and it is a legacy of apartheid that the new government has really been unable to eradicate. I think Mbeki will be held sharply accountable for those shortcomings of the society.
Would you think the new government has been unable to eradicate poverty because it's so entrenched or because the government has not followed through on what it promised to?
I think that Nelson Mandela and the ANC back in 94, when they were campaigning for election, made some very lofty promises that they were simply unable to keep. They spoke of things like a million houses by the next election, which is coming this June. They've built about a quarter of those. They may have simply aimed too high. They've also chosen a rather conservative economic course that has greatly pleased institutions like the World Bank and the IMF, but have left many township activists, the people who once supported the ANC, furious. One of the people who I profile in my book is a woman named Adelaide Busso. Adelaide is really emblematic of the dilemma that South Africa finds herself in. She is a domestic worker, a squatter who lives in a metal shack outside Cape Town. She also now sits, is a councillor on the city council for one of the wealthiest communities in South Africa. Indeed, it's the community where she cleans floors and toilets still. So in Adelaide, we have the figure of a woman who has attained political power but still has no economic power. And that is very much the situation that many blacks find themselves in today in South Africa.
You also say that there's a new black elite. It's a small group, but it's a growing group. And you profile somebody who's a member of this group. She heads a cleaning service and drives, I think, a Mercedes.
Yes, Tumi Madise was a fascinating person to follow around. She runs what has now become the largest a firm of domestic workers in South Africa. I call her the apartheid jiu-jitsu artist because she has been totally unapologetic in turning apartheid on its head. The way that she's done that, as she explained to me, was to assess very coldly and unsentimentally where people are coming from. She grew up in Soweto, was kind of a tough street-fighting kid, and has still maintained those qualities. So what she told me was that the white English-speaking South Africans are very racist, and they think that blacks can only clean toilets. And she said, I tell them, I'll clean your toilets, but you're going to pay me a lot of money to do it.
You profile several people in your new book, Fault Lines. One of them is Paul Erasmus, a former member of the security branch of the South African police, and this was the branch that went after dissidents and often tortured them. One of his victims, someone who he was involved in the assassination attempt of, is a minister who was tortured for several weeks for refusing to name the names of communists. Tell us more about why this minister was the target.
In the late 1970s, Frank Chikane was a pastor of a black church in a small black township outside of Johannesburg called Kagiso. He came to this community in 1976, which was a very fateful year in South Africa. It was the year of what has now become known as the Soweto riots, a watershed uprising of blacks against apartheid. All of a sudden, Frank Chikane found himself in what amounted to a war situation where his congregants were being rounded up and thrown into jail, and he intervened at the request of his congregants. And he very rapidly rose through the ranks as a very eloquent and forceful defender of the rights of black people, both in his congregation and beyond. Chikane became the head of the South African Council of Churches in the late 1980s. As a result of his efforts, Chikane endured 3 rounds of torture, 6 rounds of detention, a year of hiding, and ultimately, in 1989, an assassination attempt where his clothes were mysteriously poisoned. He actually fell ill in the United States. He had come on a high-level church delegation with Archbishop Tutu and others to meet with President Bush, and he fell ill, and it was here that it was discovered that he had been poisoned.
Paul Erasmus, the member of the South African police who was involved in the assassination attempt of Chikane, Erasmus went public to the Goldstone Commission. This was the commission that was investigating state-sponsored violence in South Africa. Why did he go public and confess to some of the acts of torture, et cetera, that he committed?
Paul Erasmus was a member, as you said, of the secret police. He had a falling out with his superiors. Basically, he had was centrally involved in attacking anyone deemed to be a anti-apartheid activist, and finally found the strain of the work that he was doing, which involved often going around at night, firebombing people's homes, and in the case of Reverend Chikane, being involved in scoping his house out. And then Erasmus's partner later returned, according to Erasmus, to do the actual poisoning of Chikane's clothes. Erasmus had asked for, was suffering from a variety of symptoms related to stress. He wasn't able to sleep. He has a son with cerebral palsy, and so he was moved to another police station outside of Johannesburg. He thought it would be a low-stress job. Instead, he got into a big fight with his boss. The result was he was frozen out. His money was kept from him. His house was seized. And so as Erasmus told me, when the police turned on him, he turned on the police. And he then went to the Goldstone Commission in 1994 on the eve of the elections that brought Mandela to power and told everything that he knew about this, the former white government's involvement in state-sponsored terrorism.
Paul Erasmus, the cop, and Reverend Chikane, who was nearly assassinated, had something of a reconciliation. Tell us about that.
Well, Paul Erasmus is quite haunted by many of the things he did. So in 1995, he called Reverend Chikane. Reverend Chikane is now the top aide to Thabo Mbeki, the man who will likely become president in June. And he called to say that he was sorry for what he did. He had actually hoped to meet with Chikane, but Chikane replied through an intermediary with a very pointed question. Will you tell me who actually poisoned my clothes? Because Erasmus has maintained, well, he didn't actually put the poison in. That was his partner. Erasmus said no. His partner would have to come forward on his own. He didn't want to rat on his old friend. And so Ciccone said simply that he would agree to speak to him on the phone. Well, when the phone call finally came, Erasmus described to me how nervous he was. He was afraid that, like many of the people that he once terrorized, that Ciccone would upbraid him and berate him for the things he did. Instead, Erasmus was dumbstruck when Ciccone asked how his family was doing and then said that he forgave him.
You've reported on the work of the Truth Commission, and you talked to Ciccone about how he felt about the Truth Commission, and the near reconciliation that you just mentioned is very related to it, because Erasmus went public about his deeds. He's not going to be prosecuted for what he's done, and he's been given some amount of forgiveness by one of his victims. What did Ciccone, the victim, have to say about the Truth Commission?
Well, Ciccone is in an awkward position. He's a political leader in South Africa and was among those who advocated having some kind of truth commission in lieu of Nuremberg-style trials. And yet, in his own personal life, he has found it very difficult to forgive not the foot soldiers like Paul Erasmus. He told me that he understands the foot soldiers. At one point he said, you know, I know what these guys went through. They were taken at age 18. They were put into the army, as every South African white male had to serve in the army. And they were told that we were the enemy. We were there to tear down their homes and blow up their businesses. So he said, I understand they fought with their heart and soul. He said, but it's the leaders, the F.W. de Klerks, the P.W. Botas. These are the former presidents. He said, those men are profiting from our misery. And to this day, they draw double pensions for the suffering that they inflicted on our people. He said, those people I've not forgiven yet.
What were your personal impressions of Paul Erasmus?
Well, when I met Erasmus, it was real cloak and dagger stuff, just arranging a meeting with him. There have been two assassination attempts on Erasmus's life by his former police colleagues because he has revealed the various nefarious things that the former government did. And so when I came to meet him, it was I was to come to a certain town, call from a payphone, and then meet him at a neutral meeting place. I was not allowed to see his home, his family, his wife. My impressions on meeting him were that he's a very complex character. He still has some of the swagger of his old days and a bit of pride in having been, in his own mind, a good cop, although being a good cop just also happened to make you a terrible and morally bankrupt person, as he would probably acknowledge. Probably the most vivid image that I have of him came when we were about to leave. We spent about 12 hours together, and it was at his insistence that we just do this in a long sitting where he just told his whole story of killing and firebombing and harassing. And we walked outside, and it was about midnight, and we stood next to his car, and there was a kind of a crescent moon out, and Paul was very agitated and nervous, and he said to me, he said, maybe I've wasted my life, he said, and I saw that he was fidgeting, and I couldn't help but say to him that, are you spooked being out here? And just then there was a loud firecracker crack in the distance, and he flinched and wheeled around. Of course, there was nothing there. And he said, yeah, well, he says, it's part of my condition now, my post-traumatic stress. And then some kids were walking up the block, and they looked fairly innocuous to me. One was wearing a hooded sweatshirt, but he could not take his eyes off them. He had become quite paranoid. And it struck me that the night had turned on him, and the night was where he did his best work. But now he's haunted and lives on the run. And I guess the overall image I had was of the power of one's conscience to haunt you for many years to come, long after the bad deeds that you've committed.
My guest is David Goodman, author of Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is journalist David Goodman, author of Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa. Now, you mentioned that Reverend Frank Chikane, a minister who was tortured by the South African police, and there was also an assassination attempt on his life, that he was willing to forgive the foot soldiers, the police, but he wasn't willing to forgive the people who ordered them to assassinate and who ordered them to torture. And he wasn't able to forgive the former white presidents who ruled over apartheid. You actually paid a visit to one of those former presidents, P.W. Botha, who was in power from 77 to 89. He's not somebody who gives interviews. How did you manage to talk with him?
Well, it's well known to journalists that P.W. Botha doesn't talk. Didn't talk then in the 80s and doesn't talk now. He was the strong man of apartheid. And throughout the 1980s, it's fair to say he was probably the most hated man in Africa. He was singularly identified with the finger-wagging, scolding, kind of belligerent attitude of the white government. I met Botha by accident. I was in South Africa with my family, my wife and my daughter, who was then 4 years old, and we had set off from Cape Town for a month-long trip around the country. Well, one day out of Cape Town, my 14-year-old car that I had just bought blew its transmission, and we limped into a small town called George, where I promptly deposited the car at an auto repair shop and had to figure out what to do for 3 days. Well, the only thing I knew about George was that it was the home to P.W. Botha. And so I went to a museum where they had a P.W. Botha wing, and I asked them, could I speak to Mr. Botha? And they naturally laughed and said no, but they said they'd give him a call. One thing led to another, and P.W. Botha got on the phone and explained to me that, no, of course he wouldn't see me. He doesn't speak to journalists and doesn't do this kind of thing, and journalists have caused him nothing but misery in his life. But I pointed out that I was 10 minutes away from his house. That gave him a little pause. And finally, he relented and said, okay, you can come over tomorrow. We'll speak for 30 minutes and no politics. The next day, I came over as told. I found P.W. Botha when I came in, and incidentally, we talked for 3 hours and about nothing but politics. And I then returned to see him several months later to pay him another visit. He is as belligerent and irascible as ever, totally unapologetic and unrepentant for what happened during the years of apartheid rule. An interesting footnote to all this is that Nelson Mandela has visited Botha three times, once when he was in prison, but then twice since he's become president. And it struck me as I left Botha, and it was an incredibly bizarre experience for me to meet the man behind the legend. It struck me that there are actually similarities between Botha and Mandela.
What are some of the similarities that you see?
Well, both are men of principle who have stuck to their principles, perhaps to a fault and to great personal sacrifice. Mandela, in his case, it cost him over two decades, nearly three decades in prison. And Botha, it ended up forcing him from the presidency in 1989. Their moral stature cannot be compared, but some of their personality traits, and indeed they apparently get along fairly well, there certainly are those things that one sees that both of them shares.
You mentioned that you had once accompanied Nelson Mandela on a trip back to his former prison. What did you learn about Nelson Mandela on that trip?
I accompanied Mandela along with a small group of journalists and an entourage of prison officials, actually. It was a very unusual visit, into the place where he was last in jail. It was actually a small cottage on the grounds of this prison, which was set in this bucolic setting out in the wine country, kind of like the Napa Valley of South Africa. And it was there that Mandela turned to me and said, "These were the best years of my life," he said as he walked into this. And I looked at him rather shocked and said, "But you were a prisoner here." And he said, "Yes, but this is where I first met the new leadership, the young leadership of the African National Congress, the people who are going to lead the country now. And we first began to share views on what a South Africa after apartheid would look like." It was also quite touching because it was the place where he was then reunited with the man who was his jailer. This fellow named Brigadier Swart was a tall, thin, middle-aged Afrikaner man. He was Mandela turned at one point and said, "What has become of him?" And the prison official said, "Well, he's standing outside." And so in walks this very nervous-looking man in a suit. And Mandela turned to him and held his hand, as he often does, and looked him in the eye and said, "I will never forget the kindness that you and your family showed me while I was here." In fact, Swart often would bring Mandela home, and his wife would cook him meals. And Swart became very teary-eyed, and then Mandela sort of broke the tension around it by then asking him about his children and whatnot. But it was and has been Mandela's ability to cross political divides and touch people's hearts that I think has made him such a remarkable leader and such an icon of reconciliation there.
Well, David Goodman, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you, Terry.
David Goodman is the author of Fault Lines, Journeys into the New South Africa. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. By the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And garden.com, an online source for gardening advice and home delivery of over 14,000 plants, tools, and gardening products. And by Putumayo World Music, presenting Celtic Tides, featuring the Chieftains, Clannad, and others, available on CD, video, and DVD, and airing on Bravo on March 18th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, why today's meat is tougher than it used to be, and how to cook it so it tastes tender and juicy. We talk with Bruce Adels, co-author of The Complete Meat Cookbook. And linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the English words peppered into European languages. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. March 20th is the 15th annual Great American Meat Out, an effort to help Americans kick the meat habit. One person who won't be celebrating is my guest Bruce Adels, an unapologetic meat connoisseur. He's the co-author of The Complete Meat Cookbook, which was just nominated for a James Beard Award. He also owns a gourmet sausage company and is a former restaurant chef. If the meat you remember from childhood is more tender than the meat you're buying today, it's probably not your imagination. Adele says there's an explanation for the difference.
The farmers and producers have responded for the public's desire to eat less fat, and so they sort of put their cattle and pigs on a diet, and they've been successful. It started about 20 years ago, and so the result is that pork is about 50% leaner than it used to be, and cattle, depending on the grade, is also much leaner. In fact, in 1986, they redid the whole grading system and created a new grade called USDA Select, which is a much leaner grade than what we were all used to buying, which was Choice, which is still available, but a lot of supermarkets now carry Select. It just has a lot less fat. And the good news is that, yes, it's healthier. The bad news is fat provides flavor. and it also juiciness and sort of texture tenderness. So the issue is how to make the meat that we have today taste almost as good as it used to taste.
We have a lot of suggestions for that in your new book. Why don't you give us a couple of how to put the juices back in?
Well, one of the things is you really do have to pay careful attention to how well the meat is cooked. And this is particularly true with pork, which tends to be the most well done of all meats. And the old recipes that tell you to cook it to 180 degrees, you need to throw those out. And you need to really cook pork. It's still going to be well done, but it's going to be in the range of 150 to 160 degrees, and that's the internal temperature. And it's the internal temperature of any piece of meat that determines, you know, how done it is or not. So that's really important. The other thing is to cook things gently. If there are things like stews and braises, instead of boiling them, you know, really vigorously. And to make sure that you select the right cut of meat for the right dish. And that's probably one of the most basic pieces of information. It's kind of obvious, but it isn't that obvious, actually.
Let's get back to the pork for a second. You suggest cooking it at a slightly lower temperature than what the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, recommends. What about trichinosis? Are you risking trichinosis?
Well, no. I would never want to tell somebody that something that could cause a risk of some kind of foodborne disease. Trichinosis is killed at 137 degrees internal temperature. Which is actually sort of in the medium rare level. So I'm not saying to cook it down that low, but if you cook 10 or so degrees above that, or even 15 degrees above it, you're going to eliminate that risk. And the truth is that we don't have a whole lot of trichinosis in our meat supply, even though as a producer, I do own a sausage company, we have to treat every piece of pork as though it does have trichinosis, but the reality is that it's extremely rare.
How do you think buying meat has changed since you were a kid? What are the butchers getting different now that's different from what they used to get?
Well, it's amazing. First of all, butchers is a key operative there. Many supermarkets no longer have any butchers. They simply have clerks. So there's not that expert, that old-fashioned guy with a little bit of blood on his apron that you could go up to and say, Mr. O'Malley, what do you recommend that I should buy for my meal tonight? Those guys are hard to find. Number two, this is the other massive change that's occurred. Meat no longer comes to the market on a carcass. It comes in boxes, and it comes already cut up into sort of large cuts, which are called primals. And what's even happening is that some meat companies are even selling things already completely packaged, ready to be served to the consumer in like little meat trays, and they even have their labels on it. So I would say that the future for butchery is not that great in this country. They're sort of getting phased out. So it's a problem. One of the things that boxed meat is produced is some new cuts of meat that we didn't used to see a lot of. One of them is like pork tenderloin. Those never used to exist because they were always attached to the pork loin that had the bones on it. So you had to buy the whole pork loin and then, get the butcher maybe to cut that out for you. So it has produced another wonderful cut that's been produced from the fact that meat is now sold in boxes is called tri-tip, which is a very nice little triangular-shaped beef roast that makes a perfect little roast beef for, three or four people. So there are some benefits to this, but, gosh, the days of the butcher are just, they're numbered. And boy, if you have a butcher, if you know a butcher and you trust a butcher and you do business with him, keep him. He's like a car mechanic. Cherish him. Marry him. Do whatever you can. He's an important fellow.
Now, what about grading? Can you tell from the labels whether the meat you're buying is the top-graded meat?
Well, first of all, the top-graded meat, which I was mentioning earlier, is USDA Prime. It's in very short supply, maybe 1 or 2% of our beef. I'm talking here about beef. Comes out graded Prime. And of that, the first customer is the Japanese, who really like very heavily marbled meat. So what little is left then goes to the fine high-end restaurants and specialty steakhouses around the country. And that leaves a tiny, tiny bit that goes into some specialty butcher shops and really high-end grocery stores. So let's say that for the average Joe, he's not going to be able to find Prime. But the next grade down is the Choice. And choice is the one grade that shows the greatest amount of variation. It sort of it varies from sort of what they call the bottom end of choice, which has the least amount of marbling, to the top end. Still has more marbling than select. So that's what I would recommend most people looking for. And then a lot of stores will sell this USD select, and it's certainly fine for a lot of things like pot roast and some of the other cuts. And you just have to pay a little bit more careful attention. And if it isn't labeled on the package, if it doesn't tell you what grade, just ask the butcher, because he has to be able to tell you that. But sometimes it isn't on the package, so it is worth asking.
And if you're getting a lesser grade, does that mean it's less healthy or just less tasty?
No, it's probably the other way around. If you consider fat, a higher fat to be less healthy, then it's going to be more healthy for you in terms it'll have less fat. But it's just going to be a little more troublesome to cook and maybe not as delicious, especially, mm-hmm. you know, some of the steak cuts.
Now, how does the bacterial, you know, and E. coli scare affect your techniques of cooking?
Well, it's certainly, it means you got to think about how well you're going to cook meat. And the thing that's most important, where you have the highest risk, is ground meat. And ground meat, once you take a piece of meat that is basically sterile except for the outer surface and then expose it to the environment by chopping it up, and whatever it comes in contact with, it's going to pick up whatever possible bacteria are there. Now your risk is increased. So when it comes to ground meat, the safest thing to do is to cook that meat to an internal temperature of 160, which means well done. It still will be at 160, it still has a little bit of juice, especially if you buy like ground chuck, which has a little bit more fat in it. I think that it's not much of a risk for solid chunks of meat like steaks, because steaks are really seared on the outside, which is a high enough temperature to kill just about any kind of organism that might be living on the surface. And like I say, the interior of the meat is basically sterile.
You suggest that the indispensable tool for the chef who cooks meat is the digital thermometer. Tell us why this is so important.
Well, it's the whole name is digital instant read thermometer.
Oh, excuse me.
Because what most of us remember are these things called meat thermometers, and they were these big old clunky metal things. You stuck it into the meat, and you left it in there, and then you checked it, and it would tell you, you know, well, rare, medium. Unfortunately, number one, they were very inaccurate. And number two, they still have a lot of the old guidelines. Like, they still tell you to cook pork to 170 degrees. So forget about those. A digital thermometer is designed to take an instant reading. So you actually take the piece of meat out of the oven or whatever, open the oven door, stick that in, wait 10 seconds, and you get the reading of the interior of that piece of meat. And it's fairly accurate. It's very accurate. The reason I like digital as opposed to the dial type is because a digital actually only needs to have the tip inserted into the meat to give you a reading, while the dial type you need to actually insert a couple of inches. So they're very, very useful for steaks where you only have maybe a 1-inch thick steak, so you only have to push it in like to the middle, halfway in, half an inch, and you'll still get a nice reading so you can tell when steaks are done. So, I'll tell you the truth, yeah. Terry, though, none of us guys that actually cook a lot of meat ever use a thermometer. We use the old finger method.
And what is that method?
Well, you poke the meat, and you can tell by how firm it is, how done it is. It does kind of fall apart when you have a big old prime rib, though. And even the pros like myself do use a thermometer to tell a prime rib, because you can't tell at all by looking at it or pushing it, and because it's too thick of a piece of meat.
But for the rest of us, you recommend that digital instant thermometer.
Yeah, it pays okay. for itself the first time you don't ruin the Christmas roast, right?
Exactly.
And your family is looking at you. What is this gray mass on my plate?
My guest is Bruce Adels, co-author of The Complete Meat Cookbook. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bruce Adels, co-author of The Complete Meat Cookbook. Now pork is really making a comeback, and it's being hyped as the other white meat. You call it in your book the most versatile meat. What's so versatile about it?
Because it has this wonderful propensity to go well with so many different flavorings. I'll give you an example. Pork tastes good with sweet things, with apples, with prunes. But it also tastes really good with pungent things, soy sauce, garlic, ginger. It's just very versatile. It also has a very, very nice texture in our mouth, a good flavor. Of course, you can roast it, you can stew it, you can pan fry it. The only thing about pork, because it's so much leaner, is you just have to be careful with the most popular cuts, which are actually the loin cuts, because, like I say, you don't want to overcook them. You don't want to cook those to 170 degrees, like the old recipes say.
What about those boutique meats like buffalo and ostrich? There's more restaurants serving buffalo burgers and ostrich
really?
Burgers and ostrich dinners. And
okay, Terry, have you tried any of those?
No, I haven't.
Here's the deal. They have very, very little fat, which is good, but all these issues that I brought up earlier about really lean meats is very true. And the problem when you overcook things like ostrich, for instance, or venison, another wonderful meat, if you get it past basically really rare, it starts to get what I call a livery quality, where the meat gets very dry and pasty. And most people don't like that, including myself. So basically, you're limited to cooking these pieces of meat very, very rare. And if that bothers you, then I think that's pretty much going to eliminate trying those kinds of meats. Although, in the case of buffalo, buffalo stew is wonderful. And you can use some of those cuts from the shoulder and make some great buffalo stews. So but I don't know about stewing ostrich. I would think that would be a bad idea.
Did you grow up in the 1950s or 60s?
Yeah, 1950s. My mother was a 1950s onion soup cook. Everything had powdered onion soup in it.
What were the meats of choice that you were served by your mother?
Lamb chops cut very thin and crisp. Hamburgers made with onion soup cooked till all juices were removed. Chicken cooked till it was falling out, so you'd lift up the drumstick and the chicken would kind of fall onto your plate. let's see. She did have a bunch of casseroles, one which I really hated, called Shipwreck.
What was that?
Well, she said she learned it. During the war, I guess she worked in a shipyard, and one of her co-mates, workers, it was noodles, green bell pepper, which I hated as a kid, canned corn, hamburger, and spaghetti sauce. All mixed together and baked until the noodles got really soft and mushy.
Wow.
If my mother listens to this, she's going to kill me.
Or she'll make it for you.
No.
Well, you say in your book that her favorite spice, or in fact her only spice, was garlic salt.
Yes. Actually, the truth was it was Lowry's seasoned salt, which was a more glorified version of garlic salt. It was on everything. And her way of doing a piece of chicken was cover it very generously with Lowry's and then roast it or bake it in the oven. Fresh garlic was a rare event in my house. I think the clove that was there when I went to high school is probably still there.
Is there anything that you ate as a kid that you still like a lot now?
Oh, yeah, sure. My mother made a great brisket, pot roast out of brisket, delicious. Her short rib recipe was also very good. It's the old-fashioned one with, chili sauce, bottled chili sauce, but it's still good. And I got to admit, I did like the onion soup on the pot roast, where you basically throw in a package of onion soup and a pot roast and some stock or water. It's still pretty good. I did actually slip that recipe into my book.
Now, you have doctoral degrees, I believe, in endocrinology and physiology.
Endocrinology is actually a branch of physiology. Yes, I do. It has nothing to do with anything I've said today. Don't hold it against me.
And you were, am I right that you were studying to be a cancer researcher?
Yeah. No, I actually did it for 5 years, worked down the road from Philadelphia in Bethesda, Maryland, for a year or two. I actually studied breast cancer. But the truth was, I found that I knew my career was not in science when I spent most of my afternoons planning the evening menu. And when I'd go to the library and fall asleep on the journal papers, I knew that I wasn't really motivated.
So what was the turning point where you said, I'm getting out of cancer research and into cooking?
Well, the government took care of that. The government in the late 60s and 70s really withdrew a lot of funding for basic research. And so I, the lab, well, this was in the end of the 70s, actually. The lab I was working in was basically closed down, so I kind of had to look for a job somewhere. And the economic reality was that I was a better cook, and somebody offered me a job.
Well, since you know a lot, obviously, about medical research, I'm wondering if you have any concerns about eating a lot of meat leading to either cancer or heart problems.
Right.
How's your cholesterol?
Moderately high. Not too high. It's sort of, you know, right there. Well, first of all, I'm not telling anybody they should eat a lot of meat. I just think that they shouldn't eliminate meat from their diet if they enjoy it. But, you know, I'm not also saying to anyone that thinks that they shouldn't eat meat to go ahead and eat it. I mean, or am I trying to ever talk a vegetarian into, you know, going back and eating a rare steak? But I think that if you're going to have meat, you shouldn't enjoy it. And I that's basically my message. Just get the most enjoyment you can out of whatever you're gonna cook.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Bruce Adels, co-author of The Complete Meat Cookbook. Now, you run a sausage business. What makes a sausage a sausage?
Basically, not much. It's basically a mixture of ground meat and spices, or ground protein. So poultry would classify as a sausage. Seafood, I do draw the limit at vegetable sausages, which I kind of think is an oxymoron.
And
I don't get it.
Are they stuffed in intestine?
Yeah, that's why it's kind of weird. Someone who was a vegetarian would even want to think about a sausage. There are synthetic casings, but the natural casing is some part of the digestive tract of either a pig or a sheep or a cow. All the tissue's been stripped away, just leaving a kind of a fairly strong membrane, and that's the casing that you put the meat into.
So how do you get the intestine casings? Do you just, like, buy lots of, I mean, how does it get sent? What shape is it in when you get it?
It's a whole industry. They tend to come from countries like China, Spain, and Denmark, which are all big pork producers. All the tissue part is removed, and you just have this tough membrane. They're salted, and then they're dried, and then they're preserved forever. And we get them rehydrated in water, which re-softens them, and then we can put the sausages in. I'll have to bring it to my plant someday. Watch it being made.
Are they fragile?
Depending the size of the animal, determines the fragility. The sheep casings are the most fragile, and those are the kind that are used to make, like, little breakfast sausages or the old-fashioned hot dogs. Pork are sort of in the middle, and the beef ones are pretty tough.
Mm-hmm.
And usually you want to peel a beef casing off. You don't usually want to eat that because it's so tough.
Are you familiar with the mail-order meat that's available now, where you can send away for...
Absolutely. There's a number of companies. Well, let's go back to that issue of prime meat. It's so hard to find in most parts of the country. There's a couple of companies that you can actually purchase prime meat. We didn't talk about another wonderful thing that really helps beef, which is aging, dry aging. Also very, very hard to find. And some of these companies, they're actually in Chicago, sell prime dry aged steaks for a big chunk of money, but they're also very, very good.
Well, doesn't the meat spoil as it's going through the mail system?
It's all done frozen.
Oh.
And it's not, of course, it doesn't go through the mail. It goes
through
FedEx.
I'm taking this a little too literally.
That's why, I mean, one of the reasons.
Stamps on the carcass.
Yeah. FedEx. I mean, I ship my sausages all over the country.
Uh-huh.
And it's all done FedEx, and we ship them in a styrofoam box with gel ice, and they start off frozen. They may not arrive frozen, but they're still, you know, completely cold and fine to either refreeze or eat as is.
Bruce Adels, he's the co-author of The Complete Meat Cookbook. Yesterday it was nominated for a James Beard Award. Coming up, how Europeans are spicing their languages with English words. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Fresh Air's linguist Jeff Nunberg has been in Rome for the past few months. He's taking a vacation from America, but not from the American language.
Americans who travel in Europe get used to seeing English words pasted all over the place, but the Italians seem to do it more pervasively and more exuberantly than anybody else. I go down in the morning, and my mailbox is stuffed with flyers for the Speedy Boy delivery service and for security house alarm systems. Half the ads in the paper seem to have English headlines: Joy Machine, Born to be Wild, Your Private Airline, This Way In. Even the government isn't immune. The Italian Parliament recently introduced a procedure called Question Time, where members could rise and ask questions to ministers. If the French Chamber of Deputies tried to introduce something called Question Time, the government would fall before lunch. But in Italy, nobody makes a fuss. Part of the reason for this tolerance is that linguistic purism has disagreeable historical associations in Italy. Under Mussolini, the fascists made a point of trying to purge the language of all foreign words. Newspapers weren't allowed to talk about the game of bridge, for example. It had to be Il Ponte. And with Mussolini's encouragement, the futurist poet Tommaso Marinetti proposed a reform of Italian cuisine that included providing Italian substitutes for all the foreign words that had to do with eating. Il cocktail would henceforth be called a polibibita, or multi-drink. Sandwiches were to be called tra I due, or between the two. A bar was to be a qui si beve, or a here one drinks. But even in fascist times, the Italians didn't pay any attention to these rules, and once the war was over, they took to borrowing English words even more furiously. There's a classic evocation of the period in the 1954 film Un Americano a Roma, with the great comic actor Alberto Sordi. Sordi plays a young Roman named Nando who's obsessed with all things American. He rides around on a motorcycle wearing a leather jacket and cap in imitation of Marlon Brando in The Wild One. And the fact that he speaks no English doesn't impede him from calling everybody Joe or from peppering his speech with vaguely English-sounding phrases like, "What do you want to know?" That character's still around in the person of a type of Italian who always has English expressions bubbling to his lips. By all means, lovely, oh yes, my dear. When I first heard people doing this many years ago, I thought it was for my benefit, but later I realized they do it with each other, too. And like Nando, a lot of these people don't actually speak English. The fact is that it's a mistake to take the predilection for using English words as an indication of the general spread of the language. On the contrary, in countries like Italy, it seems to go hand in hand with a relatively low level of English proficiency, particularly compared to the nations of Northern Europe. Of course, the Dutch and the Danes borrow lots of English words, too, but they tend to concentrate on words that serve a practical purpose and that don't have translations in their own languages, words like database, stuntman, or duty-free. It's people like the Italians who borrow words like glamour, soft, or feeling. That last one really took me back when I first heard an Italian using it. I can understand why the Italians would find it useful to borrow words like database or marketing on the assumption that Americans know more about those things than they do. It's just like our borrowing words like pasta and cadenza from them. But it's odd to think of them going to Americans for a word like feeling. After all, it's not as if Italians think of Americans as a people with an exquisitely subtle understanding of the emotional life. It turns out, though, that feeling doesn't really mean in Italian what it does in English. It's just a way of saying something like positive empathy. That's not uncommon. Italians often give English words a novel interpretation. In Italy, for example, a drugstore is just a store that's open 24 hours, whatever it sells. The word blackout can refer to any interruption of services, even of trains or flights. And sometimes Italians use words that sound like English, but that don't really exist, like il footing for jogging, or zapping for what we call channel surfing. In the end, you have the sense the Italians don't really care about getting the English words right. The English language serves as a great repository of free signifiers that they can go to whenever they need a new expression. They adopt English words exactly the way they adopt American fashions like topsiders and jeans, mixing and matching according to some purely local aesthetic, so that in the end, you have no trouble telling them from American tourists who happen to be wearing the same items of clothing. It's something the French would do well to bear in mind. None of this borrowing is a reflection of any deep Americanization of Italian culture. Or if it is, it's their America, not ours.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Sam Adams. I'm Terry Gross.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, call 877-21-FRESH. That's 877-213-7374. Fresh Air is also available online at audible.com/freshair.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Book, the magazine for the reading life, covering books, authors, and the stories behind the stories on the shelf, available at bookstores nationwide. And Little Brown & Company, publishers of The Return of Little Big Man, the sequel to Thomas Berger's Little Big Man, in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, our TV critic David Bianculli talks with Nancy Marchand, co-star of HBO's The Sopranos. Also, how a man becomes a legend. Alan Barra discusses his new book, Inventing Wyatt Earp. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.